Hello and welcome back to Fear or Favour. How's your week been?
Ridiculously busy. I mean, yes.
We say that every week.
I think it's beyond. I mean, I've taken on a new role as independent chair of the London Fire Brigade's review, cultural review. So I met with Fire Brigade officials yesterday. Then after that, I went to see the Archbishop of Canterbury. Because I interviewed him for my second book. My second book is all about senior leaders and the challenges they face. And he kindly agreed to be interviewed for me for my book. So I was at Lambeth Palace yesterday afternoon. And then just now, I've come back from Liverpool dropping my son. You have to balance parenting with everything else.
Absolutely.
So I dropped my son off at Liverpool University. He's been down here for a week, reading week. So honestly, I don't know where I am, what I'm doing, but I'm here. I'm glad to be talking
to you. What's the Fire Brigade role, briefly?
Well, sadly, a couple of years ago, a fire officer took his own life. And the coroner said that there were some issues with the fire service, which may have contributed to that. You have to also factor in Grenfell and the issues that arose from that. So there's a current inquiry going on to that. So the commissioner of the fire service committed to carrying out a review of the culture of the service, you know, in terms of whether or not it's fit for purpose, whether things can be improved, whether things are going really well. And I've been tasked to carry out that review.
So how long have you got to do it?
12 months.
Brilliant. Well, that's a good, big job, but a very worthwhile one.
I wouldn't have done it otherwise. I feel it's an opportunity to ensure that a public service improves. And that's clearly what is the most important thing, is that, you know, people must never stand still. They must always change to improve.
Brilliant. Well, my week's been filled in sitting in editing my latest program. And, you know, the one thing that always happens at the end of any making of a program is all the legal notes and all the legal aspects to make sure that we're obviously very clear. We have to comply with Ofcom, but we also have to be fair and balanced in the way that we present programs. You look at some of these programs, I watch programs, and I think you can't do that. Yet it's been broadcast. So, you know, at least on the platforms that I work on, we're very fair, we're very balanced and accurate in terms of.
Does that leave them open to legal challenge if somebody decided to challenge them?
It does. It does leave them massively open. What you will find is most of the Ofcom broadcasters, so all of the UK platforms are Ofcom registered. But if you take the likes of Netflix, which is not subject to Ofcom, for example, Making a Murderer, that could never have broadcast on any of the UK platforms, broadcasts or UK broadcasters, because it would not be compliant with not only editorial guidelines, but also with legal process. It was totally one side. It was unbalanced. Whereas, of course, when we do our programs, they have to be balanced, fair, and you have to give people the opportunity to reply.
Absolutely. And those that don't are mavericks, aren't they?
They are. They are. Absolutely are. Right. So, Nazir, this week we're going to talk about something that's been in the headlines massively recently, and that is with regards to an individual who has committed the most heinous of crimes, a guy called David Fuller. Let's just give the background. So David Fuller, after 43 years as a family man and 34 years after he committed two murders, he has finally been brought to justice. And that came about because in 1987, he committed two murders. He murdered Wendy Nell and Caroline Pierce, both in their 20s, who became known as the Bedsit Murders. What ended up happening is he broke into Wendy's flat. He lay in wait for her. And when she came back, he savagely beat, strangled, stripped her naked and raped her before leaving with a trophy, which were her keys and her diary. 5 months later, he abducts Caroline Pierce. He dumps her body 40 miles away in a ditch. Again, violently beaten, strangled, raped. And again, he took a trophy with him. At the time, the detectives linked both of those murders and said that this is an individual who has killed before and will go on and kill again. And they also said the individual was highly likely to have a history of housebreaking. 34 years passed, the offender remained at large until eventually advances in DNA brought about a familial DNA hit and resulted in him being caught. He has gone to court and pleaded guilty to those murders. But during the course of the police investigation, they found at his home address a disc. And on that disc was records of him having abused women and children, ranging from babies up to 100 years old, in the mortuary. Horrendous.
Well, you can't. Well, everybody, as soon as they read about the case or heard about the case, I have no doubt that they questioned whether or not their loved ones were safe. You know, you imagine that a morgue is a relatively secure and safe place and that your loved one will be protected. And you've got a situation here where a lone man was allowed access obtained access. He was an electrician, so he had the ability to go in and out of various places within the hospital. But the fact that he, over enormous period of time, 20 years or thereabouts, he was violating the bodies of loved ones and then, of course, keeping, as you say, a filmic record of more than that, you know, a written record of what he'd been doing. Even horror movies don't seem to go down that route. And the consequences, I mean, since the allegations were investigated and since he's come to light, obviously there are other families now questioning whether or not their loved ones were safe or secure. The police have no idea whether or not the 100 or so cases where he has admitted violating dead bodies is it the iceberg or the tip of the iceberg? And yeah, nobody knows. And it's almost sad, even sadder, as sad actually, Mark, that people have forgotten the two murders. It's the two murders in themselves are, you know, horrific. You know, people, loved ones who lost their loved ones, didn't think that anybody brought justice. I think parents and others have passed away without seeing anybody brought to justice. We've almost forgotten. I'm glad you mentioned the two murders.
But you know, that's really interesting because I wrote about this in the Mirror at the weekend, and one of the things that struck me, and understandably why people were totally focused on the necrophilia, but what had been completely lost was the brutality and the violence and the death of these two young women, which was why we know about him. And there was a knock-on effect. And I think for me, it was about the public's disgust in necrophilia rather than the disgust of this man had killed two women and then subsequently gone on and committed further offences. And they seemed to be lost in it, which I thought was incredibly sad. And when I wrote my piece and why, when I opened up, I thought it was really important that we mustn't forget, you know, Wendy and Caroline, who were horrifically abused. And for years and years, their families, their loved ones have not known what took place. In relation to their murders,
absolutely. I mean, when I was working, I always was aware of the Bedsit murders being an outstanding case. Firstly, let's commend the police investigation because yes, advances in DNA enabled his arrest and ultimately his conviction. But we've all dealt with really horrible cases. Can you imagine what it must be like for the officers in this case having to go through his material, which will be, you know, which was abusive material. It was necrophilia. It was violating of dead bodies. The fact that they had to go through that in order to prepare for ultimate trial, which didn't happen because he pleaded guilty, you know, I hope they're getting counselling because I have no doubt whatsoever of the impact of what they saw. And, of course, the jury members too. You know, they would have had, and I have no doubt whatsoever, they'll have access to counselling too. We forget that the professionals involved and the juries involved in these terrible cases will also be impacted by the images. We just, all of the rest of us have to, you know, think about what they might be. They actually know what they are. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, it's as I say, demonstrates how horrible people can be.
I wonder what it says about us as a society. I mean, I titled my article "The Dead Deserve as Much Dignity as the Living," and I wonder if it's reflective in a way that whilst on one level we think murder and death is horrific, but we think sexual abuse or interfering with an individual after they are dead is even worse.
Yeah, I think that must be the case. As we said a moment ago, the murder of two women has almost been a postscript in much of the media coverage to what he did to the dead bodies. And so I think people were seemingly more offended by that. I guess partly because, you know, we've all lost loved ones, and we assume, quite rightly, that they are kept safe, kept secure, until such time as they're either buried or cremated or whatever may happen. And what this case has done is brought about a realization that actually you don't know what's going to happen, and you don't know what may have happened. And so people have, I'm glad to say the vast majority of people who work in mortuaries and with dead bodies, vast, vast majority, would never, ever contemplate something like this. And so it shouldn't be something that you should be worried about. But people began to think, that could have happened to my loved one.
But it does pose that question, doesn't it? You know, I looked, when I was aware of this and was asked to comment on it, I was starting to look around, you know, the likelihood and what the statistics sit around necrophilia. And necrophilia applies to less than 1% of sexual homicides. So if you think of the amount of sexual homicides, yet necrophilia, so interfering after the murder with the victim, accounts for less than 1%, which is obviously tiny. But you then equate that back and you think, okay, so if you wanted to have a sexual or physical contact with a dead person, then of course you, in the same way as offenders get attracted to where children work, it would attract people to those very places, funeral parlors, graveyards, those types of things. And I just wonder, and I don't say this in any way to try and scare people of loved ones who are currently going through that process or have been through, but it does make you wonder whether it is more prevalent than we know.
I imagine that we don't know what we don't know, but I think that absolutely, the victim in this case, the deceased, doesn't have a voice.
No.
I imagine most of these places don't have, for privacy reasons, CCTV, because, you know, you don't want your loved one appearing on some CCTV that they have. So one of the things that's come out of since these allegations became known, since these horrible crimes became known, was that actually people had been saying that nobody should be left alone with a corpse.
Yeah, and that came out of Savile. It came out of Savile, post-Savile, 2012, and the review by the hospitals in 2015 specifically said that mortuaries should have CCTV, they should be restricted, and people shouldn't be able to gain access to them. Didn't work for Fuller, though.
It didn't. I mean, despite the warning bells or the comments that people had made about, you know, what should happen in these cases, they weren't there, and they weren't applied, and there was no compliance, and that meant that he was able, you know, as you said a moment ago, predators, offenders of this nature are, clever is not the right word, they are absolutely fixated on something like this, and they will find every means by which they can.
They'll seek the opportunity, won't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you say, he may have had other skills, but chose to use the only skills that were necessary enable for him to have access to corpses. And we've got to be alive to that. We've got to ensure, you know, a simple DBS check isn't enough. Security check isn't enough. You've got to ensure that you have a really good handle as to who potentially is at risk and who therefore needs extra security around them, I guess.
So he was checked in 2015 as a result of the review in the hospitals, and he at that point undertook a Criminal Records Bureau, now called Disclosure and Barring, and that identified that he had failed to disclose previously a number of burglary convictions, but was allowed to keep his post. And actually, he'd gone to such a degree that he'd lied in relation to refusing to give those details. What's your thought? I mean, I was quite clear in saying that, in my view, given the role that he was performing and the vulnerability of individuals within hospitals, and the fact, you know, people have got items of personal and wealth around them whilst they're in hospital. He shouldn't be allowed to keep his job, let alone the fact that he lied and been deceived about that. What do you think?
I'm with you 100%. This is why sometimes a DBS check is just not fit for purpose. All it tells you is that at one time, it tells you at one time whether somebody potentially is a risk or not. It doesn't give you, it's not regularly refreshed. People seem to, it's a tick box scenario. No tick box prevents crime. No tick box saves people's lives. But they always apply tick boxes rather than using their judgment. In this scenario, somebody like him who's had a history of burglary, who's lied and been dishonest, who, you know, all the things that we know now were known then, and apart from what he actually did. And so I think he should never have been allowed anywhere near the mortuary, certainly not on his own, which is a clear factor here. The other issue that arises, though, Mark, is people who are in positions of care, and he clearly was, that we seem to apply a different standard, as if somehow, I think we're more forgiving of people's earlier idiosyncrasies or whatever it may be. We seem to think, well, for example, one of the reasons why we have this massive shortage of care workers, 60,000 or so fewer than we need. So maybe does that have an impact here? Do you say, well, actually, something he did 30 years ago should not prevent him from working in the care in this industry, because we need everybody. And I wonder whether that was a factor too, that, it must be quite a struggle to get somebody to work.
Well, the Rehabilitation of Offenders Act obviously wipes certain offences clear, unless, of course, you're working with children. So his would have been considered to be spent convictions, albeit the fact that he was in that position. Now, if he was required to do a DBS check, that would have meant that he was in a regulated position in order to do that. And therefore, the requirement was that all those previous offences aren't spent. They are considered. I think one of the things that plays into it for me, and this is where risk assessments are so important, and in fact, many HR departments fall down hugely, is because what they should have considered, of course, was the deceitful element of the fact that he's never previously disclosed them. And that in itself should have been a dismissal offence.
Absolutely. Whenever you're carrying out, you've been vetted, I've been vetted, they're more concerned about your lies than what you may have done. You know, if you've been, I don't know, involved in low-level criminality when you were 16, that's bad. But, you know, you've recovered, you've grown, you've become a better person. But when you're asked about it 20 years later and you say it never happened, that would be a red flag to me about whether or not that person is fit for the role that they
and that is. And that's such an important, you know, our listeners out there, and I'm sure many of them, you know, will at times have perhaps come into contact with the police, and there will be others that have got convictions. And what I say to anybody, and having you do a lot of risk assessments still now to keep my, you know, my hand in active work, is that the amount of people I say to is, if you'd have just been honest and if you'd have just told what was in your past, then we would have dealt with you in respect of that rather than considered you to be a liar or a deceitful. You know, what is the reason that you didn't pass that information on?
You miss, you know, if you've got issues, they can mitigate around that. They can say, actually, you can't have access to A, B, and C. But when they've lied, you don't know what mitigations need to be put in place. So to my mind, the dishonesty should have been the red flag that said he can't work in this field. And I think I go back to, I mean, I prosecuted doctors and nurses, who've had, you know, in one case, in the Stepping Hill murder case, he murdered two patients. He was responsible for a number of other patients becoming very sick. And what struck me then was the access that people had to bits of the hospital, which they shouldn't have had, and how lax the arrangements were. You know, in that case, if you remember, saline drips were interfered with, which meant that insulin was put there. So people who were in hospital were suddenly given an enormous boost of insulin, which led to premature death and serious harm. And the nurse in question was allowed access to stores. The stores themselves weren't very secure. so that he meant he could go in there and he could interfere with saline drips or anything else for that matter. Mm. And what struck me was, one, the lack of a risk assessment in relation to this person or any person. Secondly, the fact that people didn't seem that bothered about whether they could have access to parts of a hospital that otherwise, you and I as a member of the public couldn't walk in. Yeah. But if you work, and don't forget, a million people work in the National Health Service, so you'd imagine that they ought to have procedures in place that will secure parts of the hospital so that only those people who need access have access. And
what happens so often, though, isn't it, is that those very people who are in positions of trust, who want to abuse that and abuse people, are very cunning and very deceitful and very believing. And unless you have a clear process across the board that affects everybody, but if you make allowances and say, well, okay, he's a doctor, he's trustworthy, he's that, we have to have a process across the board, because the very people that gain access to children, by and large, are the very people who are very good at conning the wider society to get that access.
It's a lifetime mission for these people to offend. It's not something that they do because they need a bit of money or something. It's a lifetime mission. And so you've got to, I'm glad you used the word cunning and deceitfulness. It's a better word than clever. They are absolutely determined to have access to whether it's dead bodies or whether it's to children or whether it's to anything that ultimately they shouldn't have access to and where they can offend. And I think we are, as a country where I think we're too trusting. We rely too much upon process, the DBS or some kind of tick box risk assessment tool, rather than using our judgment. And our judgment would enable us to identify people like him earlier and ultimately would have prevented some significant harm that occurred.
Something that came out of certainly the work that I've done looking around necrophilia, which isn't something I've looked at particularly before, is that the sentence for necrophilia is a maximum of 2 years, and it's an either way offence. Just first of all, for our listeners, just explain what an either way offence is, and let's just explore that 2 years.
Yeah, well, the criminal offences can be one of three types. What they call an indictable offence means it's so serious that the only place to hear that is the Crown Court, which is the highest criminal court. If it's a summary offence, it means it's not that serious, and therefore it should be heard only in the magistrate's court. An either way offence is one where, because of its circumstances, it could go either way. It could be one that's serious enough for the Crown Court or one that isn't so serious, it ends up only in the magistrate's court. And the importance of that is the magistrate's court have limited sentencing powers. So the maximum term of imprisonment in the magistrate's court is 6 months for one offence or 12 months for two offences. In a Crown Court, it's unlimited. It's only limited by the maximum sentence for the crime. So a lot of cases would end up in the magistrate's court, which you and I might think were really horrible offences, but the courts can't give them anything.
And some judges can sentence longer than other judges as well, can't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So a district judge, which is a full-time magistrate's court judge, has greater sentencing powers than a magistrate who is a layperson. And you've got, in the Crown Court, you've got high court judges, or they call them red judges, and they often deal with the murders. Well, they're the only people that deal with murders and serious crimes. And of course, they, because of that, would, in the old days, before 1965, they were the ones that would wear a black cloth on their head as they're about to sentence somebody to an execution. That's how.
And that doesn't happen anymore.
Not in the UK, no. So I think one needs to recognise that. And being an either way offence, necrophilia, the view of Parliament at the time was that there is a scale of offending. So, somebody that, I don't know, I can't think of an example. I think any necrophilia is horrible and horrific and should be treated seriously.
Have you ever prosecuted a necrophilia?
Yeah, I have. There were always very serious cases, so they never end up in the magistrate's court. But apparently Parliament envisioned at some point somebody being a necrophiliac wouldn't be so serious. I don't know. Let's think out loud. Somebody dies in front of you, and the first thing you do is fondle them or something.
Yeah.
Arguably, that is not that's not as serious potentially as the stuff that David Fuller did. So maybe Parliament thought in that scenario, something spontaneous at the time, which didn't last very long, that might be only something that should be dealt with in the magistrates' court. Maybe that's what Parliament thought. It's difficult to get into the mind of what Parliament was thinking. But in other cases, obviously, the view is it's so serious it needs to go to the Crown Court. Now, your broader point is that thinking about the impact of what necrophilia is, what it means, the fact that the victim can't answer back, can't fight back, et cetera, that Parliament maybe should look at that sentence, and 2 years is never going to be enough for how the public perceive this crime.
Do you think there's other crimes that perhaps aren't keeping up with the general public's perception of justice?
As a pet lover, I worry about, if somebody, for example, was to steal your dog and you never see it again, it's treated as theft and theft of property. And you may get a pretty minor sentence for that. But just think of the impact.
But also, and I don't know if laws changed. Obviously, I'm not within the criminal justice system from a policing point of view now, but injury to a cat was always considered to be criminal damage. Is that still the case?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's changing now. The government have committed now to changing that. Whether it's changed or not, I don't know right now, but it's certainly on the agenda. But you're absolutely right. I think the sentencing should be connected to the impact that the crime has. So another example would be death by dangerous driving. Now, the maximum sentence for that was 14 years. It's about to change. And the view taken was, you and I are driving somewhere and we lose attention for a short while. As a result of that, somebody dies. Potentially, we could go to prison for a year or two for that. But that family have lost someone forever. And so what Parliament is now beginning to think about is the impact of a crime should determine the sentence. And so more and more now, even if it was a momentary lapse of concentration, you could go to prison for 10 or 10 years or more.
I've always thought that the rules in relation to the Road Traffic Act and in particular motor vehicles has never been in tune or considered appropriately, because in essence you are behind a lethal weapon when you get into that car, your vehicle, your van, whatever it is. Yet the sentencing and the outcome just doesn't reflect the fact that you are sitting in such a crucial weapon.
100%. And you mentioned whether the law is keeping up with stuff. We are now in the world of electric vehicles. We're now in the world of self-driving vehicles. I don't know. I mean, I know I've talked to Home Office colleagues quite frequently, and there is a lot of work going on in preparation for a world in which you may not be the driver of the vehicle, but you remain in control of it. So if you are in control of a vehicle, that makes you as guilty as, quote-unquote, the driver of the vehicle. And so the law needs to adapt to the new circumstances. If, for example, and there is a case recently about this where a guy was fast asleep in a vehicle that was driving itself.
In the UK? Is that a UK?
In the UK. In the UK. Okay. In the UK. And argued, didn't last very long as an argument, that because he was sleeping and the car was self-driving, that he shouldn't be held responsible for what the car did. Thankfully, it didn't kill anybody, but it did cause a crash.
Yeah.
The court said, no. you were the only person in the vehicle. And the fact that the vehicle may have, quote unquote, a mind of its own does not negate the fact that you have a mind of your own. But the law needs to keep up with that. And I think the word impact is quite important here. Parliament beginning to think more and more about the impact of someone's behaviour being a determinant of the seriousness of a crime. And, if a life is lost, if a dead person is interfered with, the public feel that this is so horrible and so horrific, but the consequences should meet that. And I think we're going to see a great deal more law change, I think, in the months and years ahead that reflect that.
And of course, government has a very important role to play in terms of laws, as does the House of Lords. But there is also sentencing counsel, and sentencing counsel have a very important role to make sure that they keep up with the appropriateness of sentences when they're given out. And certainly any judge, any magistrate are very aware of the current sentencing guidelines in relation to matters, aren't they?
Absolutely. The House of Lords, of course, is now the Supreme Court. Although there is still some people within the, particularly within one political party, want to go back to a House of Lords. Anyway, they don't like what the Supreme Court are doing. But absolutely, I think there's the Sentencing Guideline Council is a group of judges and others who make a judgment in advance about what the right starting point should be for a crime, what the average sentence should be, and what the to give as much support and what circumstances or factors people, judges should take account of when they're delivering a sentence. And that's absolutely essential for consistency. Mark, if you were, convicted of a crime in Surrey, you should, and it's the same circumstances as a crime that takes place in the north of England, you should get the same sentence as that person in the north of England. And that's what the Sentencing Guideline Council is about. And the guidelines they issue are about trying to ensure consistency. Now,
sorry, go on, carry on.
No, I mean, that's difficult because every case is different.
Yeah.
And every person is different, but they do their best in the circumstances.
I think something's interesting there. So when I was embedded with New Scotland Yard's paedophile unit, some years ago now, I spent a year embedded with their paedophile unit. And one of the things that was very interesting is that they were taking their cases of child abuse material outside of London, and they were taking them to individual courts around the home counties. And the reason that they were doing that is that they were finding that because so many cases were being brought to the London courts, that the sentencings weren't as high as they were if they were going to the home counties courts. Now, that's an interesting reflection in terms of how it's perceived.
Factor that maybe our listeners won't know is that actually there's only one Crown Court in England and Wales. It just happens to sit in different places. And so there's nothing to stop. You probably heard, the Yorkshire Ripper was tried at the Old Bailey, for example, even though the crimes didn't happen in London. So the reality is there's nothing to stop that from happening. There's nothing to do a bit of court shopping, try and find the right court potentially for the right crime. It reminds me of something that 20-odd years ago, Snaresborough Crown Court, which is in East London. If you were charged with handling stolen goods, prosecutors could not get a conviction. And the view was, and it wasn't my view, and I make that very clear right now, the view was that the jury members were up to their eyes and ears in handling stolen goods. The Del Boy type scenario. And so what the system did, the court service, the judiciary did, and Ministry of Justice did, was they decided to extend the jury pool. So it wasn't limited to East London. So people who were jury members in Snaresbrook were no longer, could have been from West London, could have been from North London. Well, up to that point, they were from East London. And it had a massive impact. Within a year, many more convictions for handling stolen goods were resulting. So I can see why, I can see why they did that. But as I say, it's not a comment on East London. So please, East Londoners, it's not me saying that. That was a view of judiciary back in the early 2000s. But there was nothing to stop. It shouldn't happen. There should be consistency. But there's nothing. I can understand why the paedophile unit felt that they would get a more impactful sentence in a different court.
And it is quite interesting. When my time in the police, I used to, particularly for the serious crimes, I used to crime them. So we had a computer system in those days that you would crime, you get an allocated crime number, but you also had to crime the location of the offence. Now, often it wasn't always clear where the offence took place, or it might take place in multiple places, or if perhaps the offenders offended across borders, you might end up with different forces. But what I used to do, particularly for the serious offences that had offenders operating across different force areas, I would crime it within the jurisdiction of the Central Criminal Court. And what that always used to do is it, by and large, used to get me the trial at the Central Criminal Court.
Yeah, absolutely. People may not know, Central Criminal Court is actually a City of London's court. So if, the strangest thing is, if you're involved in the shoplifting in the City of London, you end up at the Old Bailey, you know, which is not exactly where, you know, where Crippen, you know, it's not the place you want to end up. But in, you know, in theory, the Central Criminal Court is the City of London's court. But we all know it's the court where our most serious crimes are dealt with. And but it, you know, as I said, there is one Crown Court for the whole of England and Wales. So I understand. I used to, if we weren't sure about location, we would always do in the jurisdiction of the Central Criminal Court, yeah. And then make a judgment later as to where that case should be tried. And you know, in this day and age, you don't know where things happen. You know, particularly, for example, the online world, which we've talked about before. You know. Did that crime happened? Where did it happen? It happened in the cloud, you know. Yeah. But you know that we can't prosecute them in the cloud, can we? And so, or maybe we can in the future, but right now we can't. So we've got to be able to find a real life place, and that's why we use that term in the jurisdiction of the Central Criminal Court.
I remember taking one guy to the Central Criminal Court for horrific child abuse. He'd abused lots of different people, and actually there was a. It was at the time where child abuse material was in its early infancy in terms of pseudo images, and the new crime had just come in. And there was a photograph that he'd created of the sexual abuse of a member of the royal family. And as far as the images go, we decided that we'd put that towards the top of the bundle that the judge was going to see, to hopefully that he would then go and give the hardest sentence. And in fact, I even asked the Crown Prosecution Service if they would prosecute treason, because in the true sense of the word, the offence is that the what had occurred was treason. And I got a very interesting response back from the CPS lawyer, which was along the lines of, you are right, technically this is a treason, and then set to tell me when the last time treason was prosecuted in the UK.
I'm afraid we try our best to try and demonstrate how serious a crime is. And, you know, saying something or doing something in relation to the royal family would be, in the old days, it would, you know, off with his head, wouldn't it? I mean, it was that's what the Tower of London was built for. These days, I think we're a little bit more relaxed about these kinds of things.
In terms of plea bargains, always interest me as well, because, and I know we've alluded to some of this in previous podcast, but again, I remember another guy I took to the Old Bailey, and the lawyer, our prosecutor said to me, you know, he is accepting some of the pleas, but there's two pleas that he won't accept, and in essence, it was a plea for the start of the pattern of offending, and then there was one towards the end of the offending. It was kind of almost in the middle. And the reason they didn't want it is they didn't want to show that he'd been offending for some 34 years. They wanted to be able to show that it happened at the end. And I said, no, I wasn't prepared to accept that. We'll go to a full trial. And it was a Friday morning they'd asked that. And she said, well, I'll put it back to them. And he pleaded not guilty to these matters prior. He'd had his fish and chips. And then after lunch, he came back and changed his mind. And it was always those things that sits in my head and think, do you know what? Just a fish and chips on a Friday afternoon will get a defendant to change their plea.
Maybe we should make them available on legal aid. But I think it's a very valid point about when you've got offending of the type that Fuller was involved in, which is potentially 100, if not more, 100 counts of necrophilia in effect. You can't have an indictment with 100 counts on it.
No.
So you have to be selective. And generally, the way we are selective, or I'm not there anymore, is that you would pick something near the middle, near the beginning, near the end, to be able to tell the story. And the length of time somebody has been involved in criminality is quite critical in terms of sentencing. They can't argue it was a one-off. You know, it was a 14th of June, that's all. But hang on, about 5 years ago and 5 years later. You know, so it's important to tell the story. And the way one does that is by selecting counts that reflect the journey that offender has been on.
It's funny though, because CPS did go through a stage. I remember that there was one stage that the force, I remember specifically my superintendent saying to me, Mark, you are the direct result of this force now having a serious sexual offences problem. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, because you've arrested a significant number of people, but because of two of your cases have resulted in over 150 individual charges per person, you have now put the statistics through the roof. And what happened is CPS moved away from specimen charges and they charged every single offence. I know it's obviously moved back again, but we were charging every single offence, which obviously took the statistics through the roof.
No, I don't think the CPS didn't have any choice. Judges said that this is the CPS wanted to, the prosecutors wanted to charge 1, 2, 3, reflecting the journey that a criminal has been on. The judges said, all right, okay, I'm just going to sentence him for 3 crimes then. Oh my gosh. And then, all right, well, we'll charge them all again. So, but you're absolutely right. I think that, when you've got multiple offenders or offenders who are involved in multiple crimes, the figures can massively be skewed by that. Mm. One of the things that really bugs me is when you read in the papers somewhere, it says criminal gang given 450 years imprisonment.
Yeah.
What they actually mean is 90 people were given 5 years each, right? Yeah. But they always present that as cumulatively. And I always take them to task over that. That's not true. It's not, if we want to educate our public, and our listeners are our public, we want to educate the public about how the system works. We can't lie to them and say they got 450 years. They got 5 years each, right? Yeah. And don't pretend otherwise. And, I always take them to task over that. And please, by all means, any listener in this, listen to us, do the same.
I think taking it back to David Fuller, David Fuller commits 2 horrific murders in 1987, very well planned, very carefully executed in terms of the way that he did it. He was very organized. He took the trophies. And of course, what we do know is he moved on and committed offenses against the dead. What we don't know is those intervening periods of time. And one of the things that I very clearly spoken and written about is my concern about him as being an offender thereafter. So he commits 2 murders in 1987, yet he's not being prosecuted for any other murders. There are nearly 3,000 unsolved murders in the England, Scotland and Wales. And one of my massive concerns, and in fact, I wrote about it, and a couple of people in the police force came back to me, cold case reviewers, and said they are specifically now going to look at him in relation to a number of their unsolved murders in their force area. Yeah. And it does highlight for me one of the issues about how this all came about, because he pleaded guilty in relation to these. So as a result of pleading guilty, of course, there isn't a trial and there isn't all the information that comes out. And I have my experience of those people who plead guilty, particularly when they are serial offenders, is they plead guilty to restrict the continued investigation or further information coming out.
I agree with you. I think we've wised up in recent years, and I know the cold case work has done that. I think that this guy got away with 2 murders in 86, 87. He's not, experience tells you and I and anybody else who has any understanding of the justice system that he won't just stop there.
No.
And, it's particularly when he got away with it or seemingly thought he got away with it. Mm. And they were predatory crimes. They weren't like, just violence for violence sake. So like you, I am seriously concerned that there will be other crimes that he's responsible, other murders he's responsible for. And I hope that the authorities don't simply close the file and think, job done. Because and I know there'll be lots of bereaved families thinking who have, who've suffered their loss in the similar ways to the 2 murders here, that perhaps Fuller might have been responsible for those. The other hope, of course, is that now he's lounging in a prison cell and potentially for the rest of his life, that he comes clean, in a post-conviction interview. That doesn't happen very often, but who knows? I hope he does the right thing and it tells us what he did.
The very scary thing about Fuller, and it will apply to other people out there, is that the people amongst us, the person that holds open the door for you when you walk into the supermarket or the pub, they may well have a history. They may well have a background. They may well be a killer.
You know, you mentioned 3,000 unsolved murders. I mean, that's 3,000, potentially 3,000 murderers. And, you know, we used to have a situation where you were always convicted of murder. It was 98% or something. Now it's down to less than 90%. So even those charged with murder aren't necessarily going to be convicted. So I think we are in a world where we are much more aware, I think, and less risk averse. And, you know, we do question authority in ways that we didn't do previously. We shouldn't scare people. You know, at the end of the day, we're a 68 million population. If there are 3,000 murderers out there, that's still a small number comparatively. I don't want people to feel scared by what's happening. But it does tell us that, you know, again, it's that word trust we use pretty much at the outset of this podcast, that people need to be less trusting. Trust should be based on evidence. Don't trust people just because they're in a certain role or a certain position, you know. Base it on evidence, and all those who carry out the assessments need to do the same.
And the other thing that I always talk in terms of when I talk to other people in the criminal justice system is gut feeling. You know, you have to be careful with it because you have to make sure that it doesn't become obsessive. But I'm a strong believer that gut feeling is something that we have to follow, particularly when you've got experience and you've worked in an area for a period of time. Is that I'm a strong believer that gut feeling does play a really significant and important role. And if that gut feeling means that you're going to dig deeper, you're going to ask more questions, you're going to be more thorough, then that's absolutely right and what we should be doing.
Gut feeling based on evidence, yeah. Gut feeling based on experience, absolutely. Not gut feeling based on bias. A problem we've had is, you know, I need to stop that group of black men because whatever. And you end up having a 9 times increase in stop and search for black people. So absolutely, gut feeling based on experience. You know, you've done 20, 30 years, I've done 20, 30 years. It's not a case of, you know, we're wiser than anybody else. We just know more. We've seen more. And we come across a situation and we think, actually, we've come across as something before. And therefore, we can make a judgment about this. But the important thing is that we then investigate it. Don't assume guilt. Assume, you know, find use that as the means to investigate whatever concerns you may have.
I think one of the other things, and it's, I think it's really important always to give balance, is that we're talking about David Fuller, and we talk about these crimes because they are rare, because they are not what's happening every single day. And it's good that we talk about them, because what it does is it tells us as a society that we still find that behavior abhorrent. We don't accept it as being the norm. We don't accept it as being something that doesn't disgust us. And I think that is still a good thing. As a society, there still is a moral compass.
Absolutely. I mean, our murder rate is a lot lower than some countries you can think of, including, you know, our brothers and sisters across the Atlantic, you know. So we need to put things in perspective. You know, murder is still the most horrific crime on the statute books, and quite rightly so. It doesn't happen as frequently as other countries. And we do take it immensely seriously. That's why there's a murder squad. That's why there are murder detectives. That's why proper investigations are carried out when there is a death in these circumstances. So I think people should feel reassured that it remains something that we will never be blasé about.
Well, that almost brings to an end. I think it's important that we say, you know, we are, our thoughts remain with Wendy Nell and Caroline Pierce's family. And we are, you know, very pleased now that they have finally at least got some answers, albeit that will never bring back their beloved family members and the pain that they've had to endure for all these 34 years that have passed by. Nazir, as always, you're a star.
Thank you. And as you just did for Wendy and Caroline, I want to share my thoughts with those whose families think or may have had their loved ones interfered with and violated. I think that, you know, I don't know how they probably dealt with bereavement, and now they're having to re-bereave, if that word exists. And so I think it's really important to remember them as well. They will undoubtedly have to get, hopefully get support in the weeks and months ahead.
Brilliant. Well, thank you, Nazir. As always, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends. Do drop us either an email or make contact through the social media site. It's great to have you on board. Stay with us for next week, where we will bring you another very exciting podcast. Thanks very much. Look after yourself, Nazir, and see you next week.
You too. Take care. Bye now.
Take care. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.